one of the great buzzwords of our time. From Silicon Valley billionaires like Mark Zuckerberg.
We should explore ideas like universal basic income to make sure that everyone has a cushion to try new ideas.
To former Labour leader Ed Miliband.
The reason why I'm attracted to this is it speaks to what kind of society do we want to be.
To the People's Chancellor, John McDonnell.
I can see the argument for basic income incrementally developing in that way. So you can see people saying, well, actually, yes, maybe all people should actually have a relative level of income that enables them to have a roof over their heads or prevents them going to food banks, that sort of argument.
Welcome to this week's Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper from the LSE, and my co-host Zoe Williams from The Guardian. With such a wide range of supporters, and with so many different models of the universal basic income out there, it can be a hard debate to make sense of. So it's the perfect subject for the latest episode of our Saving Europe from Itself series, where we take one big idea from one big thinker and put it through its paces. Explaining the UBI for us today is economist and financial journalist Stuart Lansley, a visiting fellow at the School of Policy Studies at the University of Bristol and the co-author of Universal Basic Income, an idea whose time has come.
The idea of a basic income was once dismissed as a utopian pipe dream, with its promoters viewed as somewhat eccentric. Yet recent years have seen a significant upsurge in interest, taking the idea from the fringes of debate and up the political agenda. In essence, a basic income would provide a guaranteed cash payment for all, no questions asked, creating, for the first time, a condition-free income floor. Such an idea has been advanced by leading thinkers over many centuries. They include Thomas More in the 16th century to the champion of democracy, Thomas Paine in the 18th, and J.K. Galbraith and Martin Luther King in the 20th century. Recent converts include several Silicon Valley magnates, while Barack Obama has signalled his interest in the idea. Today, the idea is gaining support across and outside Europe. Trials are underway or have taken place in several countries around the world, from Kenya to Finland and the Netherlands. In many ways, the UK is behind the curve on the international debate. Interest in basic income is being driven by rising economic insecurity and concerns about the disruptive impact of the robotic revolution. In the UK, poverty is now institutionalized, embedded in an economic system that works disproportionately in the interests of a small financial and corporate elite, and a social security system that has been greatly weakened in the last decade. While recognising that basic income is no panacea for all our current ills, supporters claim it would cut poverty, boost security, and support unpaid labour. For them, it would provide a new vision for social protection in today's much more turbulent world. Crucially, a basic income would be a new source of personal empowerment, providing all citizens with much more choice over work, education, training, leisure, and caring. It would also extend the universal model of support, one that has been badly eroded in recent decades. There are two different ways of looking at basic income. One is to see it as a much needed reform of the existing systems of social security. The other would see it as embedding a fundamental new principle that basic income is a right of citizenship, a citizen's dividend paid on an equal basis to all. It would be financed by the returns from a commonly owned capital fund built from national wealth, most of which is inherited from the efforts of earlier generation. Despite these merits, the idea remains highly controversial. Critics say a basic income would be too expensive, that it would encourage idleness, and that it offers false hopes. So which side is right? Is a basic income feasible and affordable? Would it be empowering? Would it help heal today's broken system of income support and insecure economy? Would it kill the incentive to work?
Okay. Hi, Stuart. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
That sounded like at the end as though you were asking a genuine question, but surely that's rhetorical. You think it would work, right?
Yes, I was a bit of a skeptic, and then I started looking at it in some detail, and was certainly attracted by some of the claims. So I did some work with a colleague, Howard Reed, to try and test whether it would be feasible. And we did a number of studies which show that a Big Bang scheme, what we call a Big Bang scheme, i.e. one that swept away the existing system of Social Security and paid basic income at a pretty high level. Mm-hmm. This is now, the Big Bang approach is very much advocated by the sort of post-capitalist, post-work school. We couldn't get that to work. It would be very, very expensive, and it would make a lot of people worse off because, you know, they wouldn't be able to replicate the effect of the existing means tested system. So we looked at a more modest scheme, which we call a partial scheme. Mm-hmm. This wouldn't sweep away the existing system. Some benefits would go, but it'd be grafted onto the existing system. We pay it at moderate rates, which add up to something like £10,000 for a family of four a year, which isn't enough to live on, but it's a pretty good base. And we found that such a scheme is perfectly feasible. It could be introduced at almost zero cost through certain changes in the tax system. It would cut poverty, child poverty, by nearly 40%. It would reduce inequality quite sharply, and it would really reduce the level of means-tested in society. So a modest scheme would be progressive and affordable. Now, some people have accused us of thinking small by recommending a partial scheme. But that's where we do believe a partial scheme would be possible.
So £10,000 a year for every family. Is there a danger that this ends up subsidising low wages, and how would you deal with that problem? So if an employer knows that, you know, all of the workers in their factory are already getting a universal basic income of £10,000 a year, aren't they incentivised to drive down the wages as low as possible?
Well, interesting enough, it's actually the existing system of means-tested tax credits and now universal credit that actually leads to this sort of depressive wage effect. And that's because it's means-tested. So, you know, if your wage goes down or is lower, it gets topped up. Mm. So employers have an incentive to reduce wages because they know their workers won't be made worse off. With the basic income, it doesn't work like that. You carry the basic income whether you get a higher paid job or you go out of work or whatever. So it's actually, if they reduce wages when you've got a basic income, you would be worse off because it's not further topped
right up. I see.
So both the employee and the employer know that cutting wages would make people worse off. But also you've still got, the basic income was still, the minimum wage would still exist. So there would be a minimum wage anyway. And two, one of the effects of a basic income, by giving everybody this sort of modest income, it gives them a degree of additional bargaining power because they don't have to take any old rubbish job. You know, they don't have to take some, you know, a low-paid, zero-hour contract job because they've got this sort of platform, they've got this sort of cushion. And if anything, it could lead to slightly higher wages. So I know that's one of the criticisms that's often made, but I, when you look at it in detail, I don't think it really stands up.
Can I ask about two clarifications? Firstly, when you say a family of four would get £10,000 a year, does that basic income is paid to everybody, even children?
Yes, it's an individual benefit.
Okay.
So that would be made up of £40 for a child, which is double the present child benefit.
Mm-hmm.
£60 for an adult and £175 for a pensioner, so that's slightly higher than the current basic pension. In essence, and if you add those up, so a family with four would actually get £10,400 in a year.
Okay. And the benefits, some benefits would be kept, so housing benefit would be kept.
Yes.
But the employment support allowance would be kept, I suppose.
Yes, I mean most the two benefits that would go would be a child benefit and the state pension. The state pension would be, I mean, the state pension is getting closer to a basic income anyway.
Yeah.
And
that's one of the strongest arguments, in a way, is to say we already have a basic income except you have to be really old.
Well, no, we have a basic income for children. I mean, child benefit is a basic income. It's guaranteed. it's universal.
Well, it's not universal.
Well, it's not universal now because it's taken over people at higher rate taxpayers. We're talking about 7% don't get it, but you know it always has been universal. I mean, since it was introduced in 1975, it has been universal. So the critics find it quite difficult to cope with the idea that you know this concept of universal guaranteed income is already embedded in the British and other social security systems.
Yeah.
That it's what we're doing is suggesting extending it. You know, so for example, the R-scheme partial scheme would introduce a basic income for young people. So 18 to 25 year olds would get it. In fact, you could do that. Anyway, and there's a very strong case for that, independently of having a complete basic income, because, you know, young people are exceptionally disadvantaged compared with earlier generations. You know, the educational opportunities outside of university are slim, job market is really fragile for young people and it's very badly paid, and young people have lost a lot of their support allowances. So there's a case anyway. We see basic income as a series of step changes.
Uh-huh.
You don't have to introduce the whole thing at one go. And when you break it down, so what we're saying is, as I say, double child benefit. Well, you know, there's hardly anybody on the left who wouldn't support a higher child benefit, particularly as it's been eroded by nearly 30% since 2010. So just raising it back to its real value would put it up to about, you know, 25, well, more than 25. So, and I mean, I think the idea of a basic income for youth is also something that could be quite popular.
When you say it could actually be tax neutral with certain tax changes, do you mean that it would be taxed back in the higher brackets?
Those people who say it's unaffordable at a decent rate show the gross cost. Now, the gross cost, obviously, of giving everybody, you know, everybody an average of 50 quid a year, you know, the whole population is very, very high indeed. I mean, you know, something of the order of £300 billion.
Yeah.
But what they don't allow for is the fact that there would be other simultaneous adjustments. So you'd abolish the personal tax allowance, and the personal tax allowance costs £120 billion.
So hang on a second. Oh, okay, because the personal tax allowance is about 10 grand, right?
Per person. Yes, it is about 10 grand.
So actually, the higher brackets would be somewhat worse off.
Yes, because everybody, those who are working part-time or on very low-paid jobs don't benefit from the tax allowance, particularly because it's been pushed up.
Uh-huh.
And it is a regressive tax. So what this would do would step one of this system would be, I mean, if you took the total personal allowance with £130 billion and translated it into a payment for all,
it would
pay around £30 to everybody a week. And
That's really interesting. I didn't know that.
We, you know, our studies looked at the impact of that scheme. Just even a little tiny, modest scheme would be highly progressive. I mean, it would really raise the incomes of the poorest, you know, fifth, and it would reduce the income of those at the top.
Mm-hmm.
So the combination of the abolition of the personal allowance, and we also put up the marginal tax rate by 3% at every level. So on the standard rate goes up from 20 to 23 and so on.
Mm-hmm.
That would claw back the income from the higher income group. So all the gains are concentrated amongst the bottom half, and all the losers are concentrated in the top 20%. And middle income groups just above the middle are about neutral. So it's highly progressive.
Our listeners might need a little bit more explanation on the personal tax allowance argument, because it's a regressive way of lowering tax for low-income groups. That's the argument, isn't it? Because everyone gets the tax cut when the personal allowance is increased, right?
Yes.
It's very difficult to disentangle this from the universal credit experiment disaster, in a way, because that is a kind of right-wing version of universal basic income in a sense, isn't it? Because it tries to use some of the discourses around, like, bringing all of these different social security benefits together and turning them into a single benefit. So, I don't know, on a political and practical level, how do we get away from the dangers that this is tarred with the brush of universal credit?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say about universal credit is it's a mass means test. I mean, it's nothing like a basic income, which is guaranteed, and you keep it. So, you know, when you get a basic income and you're unemployed, if you go into work, you keep it. So your wage comes on top. So that increases the incentive to work. You know, the thing about, you know, the universal credit, I mean, it's just putting together housing benefit, all into one go. So it's a huge means-tested system, and it's kind of locking in the idea of means testing into the system. So they are completely different models. Mm. And I think we have to remember that Beveridge, you know, in 1942, when he wrote his report on the post-war welfare state, and, you know, his plans was adopted and implemented from 1948, he always intended his plan to provide a minimum income. And the way he was going to provide a minimum income was one through national insurance. So if you're unemployed or, you know, ill, you would get through full employment, mm-hmm. Through decent wages, and through, as a last resort, national assistance. So he always intended there to be a sort of, everybody would get a basic income, and, you know, in exceptional circumstances, you'd go for a national assistance, which is means tested. But means testing would be a tiny portion of it, and the emphasis of it was on universality. What's happened over the last 50 years, the universal bit has been squeezed to death, mm-hmm. and the means testing bit is being multiplied dramatically. So we now have effectively a means tested system. But also, so his vision of a basic income has never happened. Mm-hmm. You know, today, I mean, in the last 5 years, since 2010, 5 million people have been sanctioned.
Wow.
5 million have been sanctioned, either way, they've lost their benefit altogether. Mm. And we know that there are millions of people who are who given up on the benefit system because it's too complicated and it's too punitive. So a basic income would finally implement the vision of Beveridge. So it's completely different to use. It's guaranteed. Everybody has it. It's a flaw through which nobody would fall. And even though this partial scheme, it's a modest flaw, it has this tremendous power to empower people, because you've got that guaranteed income. You've got a little bit more choice at the margin over whether to, you know, take a bit longer to find a job, if you're a mother, to stay at home a little bit longer with a new baby, or you might want to start a business up. You want, you know, lots of people, entrepreneurs, you know, they try their luck, they have no income, it's a big risk. Mm-hmm. This might increase the number of people who you want to, you know, try businesses, or caring. This huge army of carers at the moment, nearly all women, who are totally unpaid.
You say this is kind of phase one, in a sense. Would your ideal be to build it up until it did replace the benefit system and it did replace everything and it was livable? Or are you moderately happy with the idea of it as kind of supplementary and quite subtle, but having a growing impact over time?
I mean, I think all the lessons of big reforms, you know, particularly university credit, that, you know, we're not good at big reforms in the UK. I think what we should do is try and raise it over time, but I don't think we should ever pay it at a livable level.
Okay.
Because it might evolve that way, because if we move, you know, if we do, you know, have a different form of capitalism, and, you know, we use productivity gains, if there are any, from the, you know, technological revolution, to work less and so on, then there might be a case of pushing it, using some of those gains to raise it. But some people want to, you know, believe in the end of work. I don't. I still think for most people, work is desirable. So I don't think we should kill the incentive to work. So if you put it too high, it will kill the incentive to work. So once you've got the basic structure in place, it can evolve according to what the public want or how politics evolves. And, you know, it might be that we that we do want to raise it over time, and we put together some ideas of how it could be raised over time. We're talking about 30 years, so not immediately. All these extra advantages, that this empowerment and unpaid labour and all these kind of things, will have dynamic effects.
Mm. Yeah.
These dynamic effects will be positive because, people, all the studies that have been done, there's been a lot of studies now, a lot of trials,
mm-hmm.
show that the dynamic effects are to raise well-being.
Yeah.
You know, that people are happier, they feel less stressed, there are fewer health problems because they've got this cushion. So it does have knock-on positive effects. And I think this, the choice thing, the empowerment thing, the introduction of a non-judgmental benefit, has huge potential to change, to liberate people. And I don't think we're overstating that. We because as I say, the studies that have been done do show, the Finland study, Finland tried a particular model. It wasn't a full basic income model, but it ended at the beginning of this year, and it was a two-year study. And the main thing that came out of that study was this increase in well-being.
Can I just raise two criticisms from the left? One is the feminist critique that this is basically like leapfrogging the decades-old campaign for paid domestic, to kind of get housework paid for. And the other is one that I don't actually understand, but, there is a kind of Petifer approach, which is this is a kind of needless stumbling block on the way to a Green New Deal. We're kind of locking ourselves into an old understanding of how we'll interact with each other socially.
The Green New Deal in the United States,
mm-hmm.
where there's a big campaign, and so some of the Democratic candidates have linked it to a basic income.
Oh really?
Yes. So I think their argument is that we're giving a basic income to women who are doing unpaid work or childcare or looking after relatives or volunteering, that will lock them in,
mm-hmm.
More than they did.
Argument was sort women out first, basically, before you give it to the whole population. Like, we've been doing this unpaid domestic labour since the beginning of time, and that needs to be sorted before you do it universally. I think that's the argument.
Basic income is not a panacea. It doesn't solve every problem. It doesn't solve the problem of low wages. It doesn't solve the problem of, the bad jobs. For progressives, see basic income as part of a much wider package, which would include tackling unequal pay more vigorously and so on. So, and I think sometimes the progressive critics of they seem to argue that basic income is a diversion and there's many more important things to do and so on. Well, but we're not. I mean, the Beveridge after the war didn't say you can have national insurance or you can have full employment or you can have the National Health Service.
Yeah.
He said we've got the lot now. The circumstances are different, and I'm not so naive as to believe, we can solve everything overnight in one go, but I think a modest basic income, which, as I say, is essentially tax-free overall, or even quite modest tax, would be transformative in its own right, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing lots of other things, tackling the different ways the rich and the poor are treated, you're tackling corporate extraction and irresponsibility and doing something, trying to build a more higher wage economy.
Can I ask, because I've seen I've seen studies from Manitoba and from Kenya and showing that it doesn't actually deplete people's work, drive to work. And the only people who work less with a basic income were, I think, new mothers and students.
Mm.
But what I've never really understood or been able to decipher is how... Well, you say you don't
you're not aiming to a world, to a kind of post-work world. But there is a problem with identity and how much of your identity is tied up with work and how much of your identity is tied up with the act of, you know, getting money for labour. And I don't know how to get part, I don't know how to kind of think myself into the next bit of human evolution so that we're not, we aren't who we, our jobs, and we don't see ourselves in that way.
Well, I think that what a basic income would do by opening up more choices is that it would mean that the nature of work, it will evolve because people will make different choices. So what instead of imposing from the top a four-day week or whatever it is, this would mean that, this feels to me like, you know, the state empowering without the state being involved. Yeah. This is about transfer of power.
So earlier in your introduction, you mentioned the Silicon Valley tech community that have become quite keen on this. And while we've touched upon this a bit in some of the discussion around universal credit, maybe we could expand it a little bit, because basically there is a very right-wing, very neoliberal conception of the universal basic income out there, which says all state expenditure should actually be turned into a basic income, and then people pay for different services with the money that they received.
Oh,
so it's completely marketized the whole public sector. And so I guess that, interested in your response, but I guess that does show as well the devil is in the detail when it comes to universal basic income. Like, what are people actually proposing that it looks like?
Yes, I mean, the pro-market and the progressive models are completely different. So, yes, the free market model is exactly what you said. And, you know, so it's been advocated by people like Milton Friedman, you know, the sort of American monetarist, by Charles Murray, American sociologist, and some of the Silicon Valley, the big American entrepreneurs that are sort of backing this are not being very explicit about whether they see this as sweeping away other bits of the welfare state or whether they see this as integrated. Nobody knows, but there is a certain amount of suspicion about what their motives are. Or that it might simply be that, you know, they're big, you know, they're now being viewed rather unkindly by the public as being too wealthy and too exploitative, that this might be a way of, you know, softening some of the criticisms they get. And that, you know, the progressive model is it's part of this attempt to bit. It's certainly not going to take away the rest of the welfare state. It sits beside, and the rest of the welfare state still needs boosting. We still need more money in education. We still need, you know, the social housing program and so on. So it wouldn't interfere. Now, you know, some of the critics, you know, would say the problem is, you know, if you introduce a basic income under a left government, you know, what happens if a right government and then uses it in that way? Well, that is clearly a risk. But I mean, what's actually an interesting example there is the Alaskan model. Now, in Alaska, they created a sovereign wealth fund by using oil, and they've used that to pay a social dividend every year, which is quite high. So it's averaged over $1,000. So a family of four, I mean, and it's had a huge, it's incredibly popular, and for obvious reasons. And in the last few years, the Alaskan government has tried to stop the payout because the recession has affected the deficit, and there's been mass protests against it. So I think the idea that once a basic income is installed, that the public would allow governments to dismantle, I think is very unlikely.
I really agree with that, actually, because the Tories, the right always kicks and screams like crazy against any universal benefit for anything, but they never actually take it away. You know, they never did take away the pension, they never did take away national insurance. So you sort of think they're all smoke and no fire. No, what is it? All gong and no dinner.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about Mrs. Thatcher, of course, is that she was only too well aware of the limits of dismantling the welfare state. And, you know, the last government did go further than she did. So, you know, there are risks involved, but I think, you know, there were risks involved in introducing the post-war welfare state.
Yeah.
Because although the truth was, although, you know, in the post-war era, there was a consensus there was still a lot on in the Tory party and in business who were pretty opposed. They were opposed to family allowances. They're okay with national insurance, and they were certainly opposed to the National Health Service. So we can't just not never do anything because we're worried that a new government might dismantle it.
Okay, yeah, strong point. What ramifications does it have for immigration, though? Because presumably you would need some citizenship criteria. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, clearly, you'd have to have some kind of legal basis for accepting. So, I mean, you'd have to link it to immigration. So, yes, you wouldn't. I don't think you'd get it immediately, but if you became a citizen, or 5-year rule or something, I don't know. But then, that would be an area of debate.
I've just thought of an annoying angle, which is that presumably this would be a little bit easier to enact outside the EU, wouldn't it?
Outside the EU?
Because the EU, when you have membership of the EU, then you have responsibilities to treat everybody within the EU in an equal way in the eyes of the benefit system. So if we weren't in the EU, we would have the right to make those decisions. I mean, I'm just playing devil's advocate.
I don't think Britain's going to be ahead of other countries. So it might be that, everybody's talking about India. It seems to be quite close. It's quite keen on the idea. Yes, I mean, obviously, if you redesign the welfare, the social security system in Germany, it's obviously, in a part of a continent where there is a huge level of
integration,
and, these issues have got to be sorted.
But there's another obvious positive way of putting it, of course, because if you had this at a European level, a European universal basic income, you would deal with a lot of the problems of the Eurozone, because is to do with not having enough fiscal redistribution between wealthy and poorer states.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. And it certainly finished on a big point of contention. How would those of us committed to a non-discriminatory immigration policy justify not giving migrants immediate access to the same basic income? But if a country did, then they risk unbalancing migration flows in the regional economy. If they didn't, they risk a two-tier workforce, where migrants do the bad jobs. Both possibilities, of course, amplify existing tendencies in our society. So it's a reminder that we must, however difficult it is, always upscale these ideas to the international level and imagine how they might transform whole continents and indeed the entire world. To listen to more of this discussion, you just need to access extra time. Members of Another Europe is Possible get access to extra material on the podcast as a benefit of supporting the campaign. To join us, go to anothereurope.org/join. Thanks to Stuart, and thanks to you for listening. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please tell someone about it or leave a rating or review on your podcast platform. We'll be back very soon. See you then.
So, especially for members, we're going to talk about basic income in direct relation to this general election, which you might have noticed is coming up. Which party is most in favour of this, and who do you see as being most likely to accept its principles? I mean, I know the answer to that already, because I know that John McDonnell is quite a big fan, right? I've seen him talk on panels about it. Is that significant, or is that just... has he just been saying that for so many years that he can't unsay it?
Well, I mean, I think that, yes, John McDonnell is certainly wedded to it, and he's keen to have a pilot if they win. And there are already several local authorities that are interested in the pilot. So Liverpool, Sheffield, have shown an interest in doing a pilot. Of course, in Scotland, the SNP have commissioned a major study looking at how a pilot might work in four towns in Scotland, And that hasn't got off the ground yet, largely because the Westminster government is sort of, you know, are not allowing it to go ahead, because there would obviously have to be changes in certain tax rules and so on. So whether it gets in the manifesto, we don't know, a pilot, but I think most, you know, generally accepted amongst the basic income school is that a pilot will be necessary. You can't just implement this overnight. So we do have to test it and check it works and all the rest of it, you know, partly in order to get public support as well and to raise awareness of it. And so I think that, you know, the politics of this are, there have been phases of interest in a basic income over the last 100 years. So they rise and they fall. I think the general view is this is a bit more sustainable, that this idea is here to stay, because there's so much interest internationally. And once one country goes, then, you know,
you get
others might go as well. So it's definitely in the national debate. I don't really see it going away. Mm. This is long term, isn't it? It's not going to happen in the next government. Well, particularly if Labour doesn't win. I mean, Tories win, you know, it did. But I don't believe there is so much going on around the world and in the United Kingdom, that all these hubs have been formed across the UK. In quite a lot of cities that are campaigning for a basic income and having conferences and, you know, knocking on door. I mean, there's a lot going on, but it probably won't happen for at least 10 years. But this is long term. This is trying to, you know, this will help the next generation. It's not our generation that will benefit. So we are talking about building a better society for the future.
One of the reasons that Labour might be cautious on the specifics of your proposal, of course, is that they're very wedded to this idea that there'll be no worsening of tax conditions for anyone apart from the top 5%, say top 20% they're uncomfortable with. And I don't know, I'm quite sympathetic to the criticisms of this that Stephen Bush has made in The New Statesman. You know, if you want to have a really a strong argument for a transformed economy, you do have to persuade people to pay for it, especially if your economic policies are going to lead to less, you know, global corporations headquartering in London and things like this, because they're less neoliberal and so on and so forth. Then you need to get money from elsewhere that might not come from corporation tax or other forms of taxation. So you need to have an argument with the top 20% that, hey, it's actually in their interests for a nicer society to pay a little bit more in tax in order to live, you know.
This need to raise taxation is absolutely critical, isn't it? Because we're not going to build a welfare state without high taxes. So, but it must come from wealth. I mean, the thing is, you know, wealth, the level of wealth is over 6 times the size of the economy. It used to be 3 times. Income's taxed at about 30%. Wealth is taxed at 2%. It doesn't make any kind of sense.
Absolutely.
There's a huge pool of resources there that could transform. But we're frightened of wealth taxes, you know, that people don't like them, even people who are not affected by them don't like them. So we have to change the debate.
Yeah.
But that seems to be, that will be one of the critical, for Social Democrats, that will be a critical debate of the next decade. And even Tories, IMF is talking about it, OECD are talking about the need to raise more money from wealth taxes. So, yes, I think that's the source. It'll take a bit of time.
And poor Ed Miliband's ill-fated mansion tax. It is incredible that Labour have, under Corbyn, have kind of managed to be much more politically savvy, actually, in terms of avoiding the trials and tribulations he got into on the mansion tax. But in principle, the concept of the mansion tax, I thought, was totally reasonable, that house price values had rocketed astronomically and that it was only right that people who had achieved huge increases in their personal wealth were then asked to pay a proportion of it in taxation when they sold the house.
I think we've deviated from the topic. And we should do final word on
final word.
Optimistic are you? I mean, you know, as you say, if the Tories get in, we can forget it. But if the Tories don't get in, do you see this becoming more part of the kind of accepted, you know, do you see this getting into the Overton window, I suppose I'm asking?
Well, I think we're edging towards that. We're not there yet, but it is on the agenda now. and the idea is spread beyond the usual fringe. There's a lot of interest in it, and I think that the way the economy is going, you know, fragility, uncertainty, and the fact that people are getting older, and we need more carers, volunteers, you know, there are lots of pressures that make the case for basic income. So I think it may take quite a, it may take two parliaments before we get it, but it seems to me that this is, that it, you know, it's more likely than not.
Thank you.
Well,
very
thanks
much.
So much for coming in. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm really excited.
So he's optimistic again.